The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media.
Oh, welcome back, Casterly Talk fans, Game of Thrones fans, Song of Ice and Fire fans, Age of Hero fans, Dance of Dragon fans. There's a lot of you out there and a lot of different things to like about Game of Thrones, which is why we're happy you're here, whether you're a book person, show-only person, show and book person, or just study the maps. It doesn't matter. We're here to talk Game of Thrones. I'm Ken Napsok, and joined this time by Lon Harris, our maester, and Rachel Cushing. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah. Andres Cabrera, who was here last time with me. I mean, we did 20 minutes alone on how much we love Tywin Lannister.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't love him? Andres will be back with the crew, especially as we break down the episodes during the season. Those episodes will air in the most likely Tuesday afternoon slot. We're going to take some time, record our show on Monday night, let everyone else rush to set and give their gut reactions. We're going to take our time with it. I hope you're okay with that. All right, that's enough for the intro. Let's dive into this. Hello, everybody. We've got a little bit of news. A teaser trailer dropped. Well, not really.
It's a very small tease.
It encompassed a lot.
It did give us a lot in about 6 seconds, an HBO, look what's happening this year type of thing. We got to see what some unsullied marching, a dragon that's Drogon, and Arya, Rachel, staring up at a dragon.
Yeah, she had a very interested look on her face, and I can't help but wonder if there might not be some dragon riding in her future, because I could just think about how much she would love that and adore that. And before we hit the record button, Ken mentioned that in season two or three, when she is at Harrenhal and talking to Tywin, and he was talking about Aegon the Conqueror, she's like, don't forget about his sister wives and their dragons as well, Rhaenys and Meraxes and Visenya and Vhagar. So it's clear that Tyrion is not the only person that has loved dragons, you know, through the stories that he was told when he was a kid. I believe Arya is also a character like that. So it'd be very cool to see her interact with the dragon.
That's so interesting that you bring that up, because I've been rewatching the show, finally catching up, wrapping up season two at the time of this recording session, and watching the Tywin Arya stuff, which is still some of the best in the show.
Oh, yeah.
My girlfriend Grace is like, I would just see a documentary on that, like just a real life Christopher Guest style documentary on Tywin and Arya.
Sure.
Tywin and Arya. But in the book Fire and Blood, which I've been reading as well, they at one point during the Dance of Dragons, one side, I forget the greens or the blacks, you guys can refresh my mind, they're short of dragon riders. Mm-hmm. So Mushroom, the little person fool, is like, well, you guys is... You know, your seed's everywhere, because you get around town, a lot of Targaryen bastards, we can find some. And some non-Targaryens ride up and rise up to the level of dragon riding.
That was going to be my question, is Arya, would the dragons respond to her, even though she does not have any Targaryen blood?
It's sort of a question that's been raised in the fandom and in the books, like Ken was just talking about Fire and Blood. I think conventional thinking is that there should be a drop of Valyrian blood somewhere in there somehow, but there have been characters where that hasn't necessarily looked like the case. Nettles, for example.
Nettles is
Sheepstealer.
A great example. Yeah.
So it's not 100% sure, so it does, you know, raise the question for somebody like Arya. And also, the show has made that point even less. So I could see the show going a different way in order to get characters like Arya and theoretically Tyrion, although you could be a believer in the Tyrion is a Targaryen theory if you want. I am not, but a lot of people are. So
because there is one other way that you could get a Stark on a dragon, which could be Bran Wargs into
Bran
the dragon.
This is a great party trick. How to get a Stark on a dragon.
Here's how you could get a Stark on a dragon. Is Bran Wargs into a dragon, and then anybody who Bran's cool with could ride the dragon.
Point.
I like that.
That's a wild card theory.
Right? Mm-hmm. Could happen. He can warg into an animal.
I like that.
Dragon's an animal.
Especially now.
We haven't seen him try to warg into things now that he's the three-eyed raven.
Right.
He's got all this power.
I was going to say, three-eyed raven, blood raven says, you know, you won't walk, but you will fly.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's what's been on my mind already.
Oh, I like that.
It would give Bran a little more to do than just be a mouthpiece for a whole lot of information. So right, I am hoping to see, if not that, then some version of that, not just to give us that callback to the you will fly line, but in terms of just having his character do something.
The other thing with Bran, though, as long as we're talking about things I think Bran might do, we had a little inkling in season 7 that Bran can not only see the past, but can have an impact. Made a sound and it caused young Ned Stark to turn around.
Absolutely.
Nobody's there. So it could be that that's what Bran is going to ultimately have to do, is go change something notable in the past to ripple effect.
Oh my God, are we getting to the Bran is the Night King theory?
Dun, dun, dun.
I'm dancing around it, but I think at some point.
I think we should definitely, I definitely want to discuss that a little bit more here in a second there. Another thing about the teaser trailer, because it's fascinating, and I want to focus on the Starks in the end game. But that teaser trailer, again, I'm saying teaser trailer was an HBO. We got a lot of Jeffrey.
It was as much a teaser trailer for Barry
and Jeffrey Wright in OG, which looks fantastic as well. Jeffrey Wright's God, Jeffrey Wright in Game of Thrones, that would need to. That hasn't happened. I'm like pausing. I'm like, that hasn't happened.
It hasn't, but could.
My gosh.
He's American. We forget. It seems like he's.
I was watching Casino Royale the other day. Yeah. It's my favorite Bond movie, and that's one of my favorite moments. But I love when Felix Unger's like, does it look like we need the money?
Felix Leiter. A Bond. Felix Unger. Odd Couple.
Odd Couple. Thank you.
Which no longer took me to tell. F you meant Felix Unger.
Thank you. But so this little 6-second clip here, Arya looking at dragons is interesting, but Rachel, you were taken by the Unsullied in the snow.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I've been looking forward to, isn't the very first episode of the series called Winter is Coming?
Yes.
So we've been hearing this for a very, very long time. And
literally long.
The end of season 6, the White Ravens flew out of Old Town. And then last season we saw snow in King's Landing. So we are finally getting to the point where winter is here. And it's going to be an extra cold winter because the Night King is coming in and he brings with him that cold. And I am very excited. We've seen certain characters with a wintry backdrop a lot. Right. The Night's Watch, Jon, mostly Starks and whatnot. But I love the idea of taking an army like the Unsullied or, you know, the Dothraki horde who are from warm climate areas. Mm. We've never seen them with so much as a jacket on, and they're going to be marching north. So not only are they marching against this like crazy unknown enemy, but they're marching into unknown territory. Right. And one of the beautiful things about Game of Thrones is that those kinds of details are things the storytellers pay attention to.
Mm.
What is... Yeah. I think just as many people die because of the weather and the conditions and the things that they have to go through as would die at the hands of the whites. Mm-hmm. And that's a consideration. That's a toll. That's a part of all of this.
Stannis and his army in the North.
100%. Absolutely. So it's those kinds of details that the show does so well. And I'm just intrigued to see that sort of fish out of water thing happening with characters who've never probably even seen snow and how they'll deal with it.
Right. Yeah, and I love it. It's something downright silly about these shows, even say Star Wars with my other fandoms. You know, it's like I love seeing characters that didn't interact for 6 seasons suddenly got a scene together. There was a lot of that going on in season 7, mm-hmm. most notably, of course, Danny and John. But the locations factor in too. Sure. Is this something just Rachel and I experienced?
Well, no, I mean, one thing we were saying just before the show where we started recording was that's something that they actually have threaded through the entire show, and characters who aren't from the North go North.
Right, right.
They react to how cold it is. It isn't just a little, you know, chilly and there's snow on the ground, it's freezing and they're not used to it and they don't know how to stay warm. Tyrion in season 1, sort of memorably, he's taking that trip to the wall just kind of for fun and then sort of almost comes to regret it because it's so miserable freezing cold. And, you know, Sam, you've heard sort of comment on, like, a lot of characters who aren't used to it, we've already seen go north, are miserable once they get there. So now we're moving the sort of whole focus of the show north, I think we're going to see a lot of characters react to
it. And I loved, Jamie Walker riding away, I should say, with little snowflakes falling, a little white Christmas in King's Landing. I think that'll be interesting, too. And
is Elia Martell going to have to go north? How southern are we going to be bringing up?
Going to do it. And then I still want to do just a cut over to Carth. and have snow falling on Karth.
Oh, Karth.
Is Zaron still, Zo and Daxo still in still that vault?
And Dorea.
Presumably, yeah.
I was in rewatching season two. I can't tell you how much I love the spice trader from Karth. Yeah. He is the most wonderfully casted, awkward, pompous, but also honest and direct, honest way. Fascinating.
I understand fascinating how character to me. The nature of adapting these books. You can't just leave Daenerys out for a whole season, so they had to come up with stuff.
Stuff.
But now that we're at the end and time is so short and there's so much story to fit in, it does feel crazy that there were like three whole episodes of like, where are my dragons? Well, I guess I should go to this temple.
Wandering through the Red Waste.
This warlock. And like it's just kind of comical business until she gets to Meereen and the other, you know, more important cities.
It kind of, you know, as we, you know, the book series still is yet to wrap up and we're pretty, you know, only book five and we got with two more books, allegedly, you know, we'll see if they ever show up. But sometimes I worry when the show starts cutting characters off that on the show just maybe come to a natural end, but I'm like, oh,
does that mean that they don't actually
factor in it all
in the books? I know.
Well, we don't know. Maybe Karth is going to come roaring back.
Zaro is alive later. Yeah. He doesn't die. So he's a part of the story in book five.
And they've looped some of the sort of slave city action through enough that it wouldn't be that surprising if they came back. Like if we did have something else with the Sons of the Harpy or Dario Naharis or some of these characters, I could still see that coming into play at some point.
Like Dario, you know, basically sending a raven to his ex-girlfriend. Hey, how you doing? It's been a while.
I mean, I'm not a book guy, so we only got a tangential reference with like the Golden Company. Yeah. I mean, that's still from Big. Essos.
Essos does seem to be at least in a small way, shape or form, given what we know of Cersei's plan based on the end of last season. So we will probably at least see Volantis would be my guess, someplace.
And the Iron Bank of Braavos remains an important location.
And we have to find a way to loop Melisandre back in too. Sure. Because we've no doubt getting her.
And so one more thing, as long as we're talking about Essos things that they have wrapped up. I've always been interested. They have mentioned Ashai so many times.
Shy by the Shadow.
Book readers say the same thing.
And yet it's always like out there. And even I didn't even remember this, but towards the end of season one, when, you know, it looks like bad for Drogo and Jorah's like, we should get out of here. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying is like, my lady, we have to go to a Shy.
Just get out of here.
And it's like, that's the only time I didn't even remember it being like reasonable to travel there. It seems like so exotic and distant.
It really is. It's one of those things. And again, reading Fire and Blood, there's two examples they do talk about Ashai a little bit, right, Rachel? Probably it's fresh in your mind. And they also go to Beleriand and Aria is Aria Targaryen.
It's one of the most fascinating parts of Fire and Blood.
It disappears. Takes Beleriand the Black Dread, but this is like when the dragon's like 200 and he's Yoda and he's ready to kind of check out. Steals it, kidnaps it, disappears. We don't know where she went for a year, but she comes back with this hideous, like, Alien 2 disease with things crawling inside her and bursting out, her skin falling off.
And Beleriand's like beat up to hell too with burns and
cut scars. No one knows, but the thought is Beleriand had control over. She was too young, couldn't control him as a dragon rider, and probably went to the last place he knew outside of Westeros, which would be Valyria, his last living creature to have seen Valyria. And it gave me chills because it's scary because then you're thinking, and what's there? What's in a Shy? Yeah. What's going on in this rest of this world? And I want to know, does the Night King worry about that too? I can't think about it. Speaking of the Night King, let's get into this kind of main discussion here, Lon. I think this is a great place to take the conversation. The Starks at the end, how do they factor in the end game? They clearly are still the main focus. And one of the first points you brought up, they're still a powerful house, which is weird.
They're one of the very few houses. Like if you think of when the show started, the powerful houses of Westeros, many have been almost completely wiped out, if not wiped out. I mean, the Lannisters are down to Jaime and Cersei.
Yeah.
The Tyrells are...
Tyrells are done.
Done.
The Baratheons are done.
Tarly's done.
Yeah, the Tarly's are basically done. So, you know, I mean, you've got one Targaryen left.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, like, we're winning. It sort of is all falling onto the Starks. They're the house that still has several viable, you know, heirs left.
Which makes sense to me. Number one, it's not surprising because you go back to season one, they're the focal point. They're the point of view house, so to speak. We start to follow them. But then by season two and three, they're falling off and you're thinking this is a broken house. So,
sure. I mean, we're down to, you know, John is a bastard
exactly.
We thought
he's
so.
He's got some Stark blood in there.
Long time, it didn't seem like Sansa would be a player. Right, Arya is going to other continents. She was, you know. Right,
basically, living on the street selling pigeons. Mm-hmm.
It's actually fascinating that, oh yeah, that's right. This is still a story about the Starks.
Right.
And they're here and I wonder how they factor into Endgame. And there's a lot of different ways because they're all prominent now. But I guess I think it's a good, interesting place to start with Bran because he hasn't always been interesting to a lot of show watchers. And at times, even some of them, I didn't miss him from the season he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I know there's wonderful, fascinating things and I want to learn, but I was like, oh yeah, and there's nothing against Isaac Hempstead White, who I think does a great job. But, you know.
He was just a character who was, for most of the show, while other characters were doing things and interacting with other characters, he's been on this journey. He's been just traveling. And we haven't really, this past season was the first time he sort of got where he was going and has started to actually work and do things to move the plot forward.
And
it feels like he was just like, it just took him a really long time to find Max von Sydow. Yeah.
Well, and even, you know, poor Rickon is gone, and Shaggy Dog might have been exactly what that trope meant. As a TV writer, Shaggy Dog is a pointless story and journey. So that was it for Rickon. Poor Art Parkinson, who was a wonderful chap. Were you there when he was at Screen Junkies the day came by? Yes. Wonderful chap. Good sport. Anyways, let's start with Bran, the Night King. All right, Rachel, you brought it up.
I know, right?
Is this the thing? Did we dive into this?
It's such an interesting theory. I don't know if I buy it because I don't think I want such a specifically direct connection. One of the things about, the Hold the Door episode and Hodor was fascinating in that it did essentially show us a time travel or a time travel loop. I'm still not entirely sure exactly how it works, but the idea being that what is happening in the past is because of what is happening in the future is because of what was happening in the past.
Right.
And
sure.
the effect, the back and forth of that, the issue on the table is that I don't want time travel to be the answer to too much, because I feel like it's a little bit of a flawed concept because it's not a real one. And every movie that's ever been made about it, you know, some get some of the science right, and then there's a lot of guessing involved, and then there's, you know, alternate universe theories and butterfly effects and all of these things. And it's a little more sci-fi than I want this fantasy series to be, but I like the nods to the idea that Bran's power extends beyond just looking and that there could be something effective. You know, like Lon mentioned the moment when he yells or he calls his father's name in the Tower of Joy flashback and Ned turns and looks.
Right.
What that exactly means, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that it means that there's more of a connection, which I think is cool. Right. But I'm not quite ready to jump on board with this Bran is every Bran that's ever been in the history of the Starks, or this Bran is the Night King. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of this Bran doing something like when he went into the vision where he saw the Night King and the Night King grabbed him. And there's a consequence to that. Those connections I think are interesting. And I used to think at the time that was going to be how the wall came down, Bran was actually the cause of that.
Right.
Because prior to that, the Night King didn't have the power to do so. Didn't turn out that was what happened, but that's the sort of back and forth consequence kind of ideas that I'm on board with rather than Bran literally being another character from the past.
I agree with that, Lon.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to actually do Bran being the Night King, because I actually think the Night King as a concept works a lot better if you don't. He doesn't need to be a character. I don't think we're really going to ever delve into his inner wants and desires in the way that we have the human characters. That's like, that's the dividing line.
Do you want that? On any level, though, Andres and I were talking about, like, maybe he's kind of a good guy. Maybe he's like, hey, the Lord of Lights, he's kind of bad. I'm here to help you.
I feel like, to me, what I like so much about the White Walkers is that it's force of nature.
I do like that.
The whole show is these sort of humans with their varying impulses and desires kind of all clashing and navigating with one another. And the reason that you can't Lord Varys the Night King,
right.
You can't outwit him, you can't Cersei Lannister him, is because he's just there to take over. He's just, it's
dominance.
It's just like a manifestation of winter itself. He's just there to freeze everything. And I kind of like that, and I feel like that makes it more powerful and meaningful beyond just like it's a fantasy. He's like, oh, he's the bad guy in this. It's you know, I think it's more archetypal. If he's, you can't reason with him, he doesn't want anything, he's just, is he even aware of humans and their desires and what they want, or is he just there to raise this army and march through the whole continent?
Right.
I kind of like that. And I think that you cheapen that the moment you're like, no, he's Bran, or no, he wanted to do this, or his goal is to do that. Though it would be a cool moment if you realized he was there to help fight some even larger menace. Like, I like that as a twist.
I like it, and I don't think I need it, but it just seems weird that he's been built up. But at the same time, he hasn't been built up. That's the thing. He's just been a nemesis.
Nemesis. But not as a character. Yeah. And I feel like that's a turn I don't know if I would necessarily love.
I'm not expecting him to all of a sudden at any point this season start talking. Like, hey guys, how you doing?
But just like, to me, the most personification we need of him is that moment when he lifts up his hands
and
all
that.
I was like, I get it. I get who you are. I get what you're about. I don't need, you know, do you ever see, I'm going to take it on a tangent for a second. There's the Land of the Dead, that late Romero, I think it's the fourth Romero of the Dead movie.
This is why you're the film professor. No.
He puts a zombie who can't quite talk, but it's like the first zombie who can sort of like reason like
bank level.
It's like when the raptors can open doors. He can, like, the zombie can figure out, test the fences. Yeah. And it's like, that's the moment where you lose.
This ferret can make a sandwich.
Right. What's scary about zombies is the mindlessness. They're just going to just keep knocking on the door.
I like that.
I think the Night King kind of in that same way, like, he's a zombie. I don't want him to suddenly be like, what if you all join my army? Like,
I would probably end up side down on that, but I like was one thing you said, and you touched upon it too, Rachel, here, that to me, after all these years of investing, and if a brand is this, seems like a cheat, whatever that this is.
Having said that, I mean, I'm not necessarily as anti the idea of brand being able to go back into a moment in history and affect something.
That's different.
Ripple effect change. And to me, that wouldn't be like, oh, it's two sides. It's like, well, they've come up with their fantasy magic explanation in this universe. He's got this rare ability to like port into somebody else's perspective. Like, I feel like they've done a good enough job that wouldn't bother me, but I agree. I don't want it to be the answer. Yeah. Like, I don't want it to be the thing that saves Westeros. And I definitely don't like Bran went back. Like, he was Bran the Builder all along. Like,
there's some interesting friend Kevin from the show Three Cocktail Questions here on Anchor. He has a show. He gets into theories. He's way better than I do. But it was always, you know, is it Bran whispering in the Night King's ear, burn them all? Is Bran the one that, you know, helped the, you know, Maegar, the cruel help him build the tunnels that maybe they'll hide? Does anything about that factor in? And I'm okay with it in that word. That's not the cheat to me, but like, Rachel, are you like the idea of like surprise masks off brand, like you said, has been every brand through time? I don't know.
Yeah, it's in. I think my biggest hesitation is this idea of when you introduce time travel, the inevitable question in every movie is, well, why don't you just go back to this time and take care of this person when they're a baby, and then all of this stuff doesn't happen. So like, the rules have to be set in place in such a way that the ability to time travel and the way that you can affect things has to be within a certain set of boundaries. I don't necessarily know for sure what those are. I suppose if we analyzed the Hodor moment a little bit more, maybe there's something we could see within that that could help explain what it is he is capable of and what it is that he's not capable of, because he cannot be like too powerful. He can't I don't want him to be the answer.
Well, it's also, there was a three-eyed raven before him who was not manipulating time and space.
Right, but was watching. But you're absolutely right.
Was plugged into the roots and was aware.
Yeah, eyes in one.
And was calling to Bran to come to him, but was not like, I'm going to stop Jaime from knocking Bran out a window, which he could have done, theoretically. So there must be some kind of limitation to this power, because Max von Sydow
that three-eyed crow, three-eyed raven, however you want to call it, book to show, Brendan Rivers. He's one of the best characters Martin has ever written, in my opinion. But things go wrong in his life, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's not perfect. So at one point, he could go back and change things.
He never did.
There's something established, but I agree with exactly what you're saying. Like, there was someone before Bran with this power.
The fact that there's been this figure in the world and that most human decisions bear out and aren't changed would indicate that Bran's not going to suddenly start manipulating time and space. You know, like, he's not going to be Dormammu all of a sudden.
The whole show ends with, we go back to the beginning of time.
I've come to bargain.
Yeah. And Bran just like snaps it all out of existence and the whole world.
I don't think that seems
like, if this was Stephen King's Game of Thrones, that is exactly what would happen, but because it's not, I don't think so.
So do you think then, does Bran survive the series?
Great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that directly. This is why you're on the show, Rachel.
That is an interesting question.
I'm still holding my theory that Danny dies. I mean, that is my, I'm putting a dollar down to hoping I win a million. But I could see Bran having to go, whether he goes to the astral plane, man, and he ain't around anymore. Or there's something to that, or that he just ends up in a cave north of the wall. He's in a tree and that's it.
Yeah,
I
almost feel like he's maybe most likely to survive in some shape or form. Maybe not as the Bran Stark we've come to know and love.
Right.
But I do feel like Bran might be one of those forces that will continue to live on.
Okay.
More likely than most of the human characters.
But I like what you're saying, a force. Like, maybe he carries out. Maybe he cannot change what he is becoming.
Yeah, maybe he becomes another part of the cave or a bird permanently or something.
The Bran bird.
He wargs into a dragon and can't get back out or
it's
something.
His final warg.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it.
He ends up in a dire wolf.
It's like Moonlight Graham in Field of Dreams. You cross that line.
Yeah.
It's gone. You're done.
That's very nice. I kind of like that.
That could work for me. Actually, kind of could work for me.
We've got a dire wolf or two that's still alive. He could end up in one of them.
He could maybe it's Nymeria. Nymeria.
I was going to say there's only two.
There's only two. Yeah.
Nymeria and Ghost.
That's it.
Rachel, what's your actual money down on the table prediction? Bran living nine.
If he does live on, it's going to be either as a human with no powers left anymore, or as like the last remnant of magic as part of a weirwood grove, as having warged into an animal or something like that. But I don't see him being the three-eyed raven with the same abilities at the end of it all.
So not necessarily like what Brendan Rivers became, just his own version of
it. Because I'm still sticking to the idea that at the end of this, magic will not be what it is at the beginning of it.
That's like the sort of high fantasy trope we're always
a new age begins.
Right, we're always at the end of the magical time. But I mean, that's so set. Like, that's Middle Earth. It was Earth. We know that this is not Earth.
Oh no, it's not Earth. But I still feel like it's the. The magic has been a part of its past. It went away. It comes back and goes in certain ways.
Oh, so like an ebb
and
flow.
But I feel like there is. And I feel like this is like a little bit of a last gasp of it because we have, it's a Song of Ice and Fire. And we have the ice, we have the fire. And I feel like this is sort of like a final clash of those things.
I like that idea. Then we can have our spinoff series, Westeros 2010.
That'll be the sci-fi cyberpunk.
A CBS procedural of crime fighters.
Well, if you think about it, if we're going thousands of years earlier in a prequel, if we went thousands of years later, I mean thousands of years after the Middle Ages,
you get
cyberpunk. So you don't know.
Some work. Let's go to other things here. We got The other Starks, there's a lot of other Starks. Mm-hmm. Sansa, Arya, Jon, we're going to call him a Stark. Yep, Aegon Targaryen the Ninth.
He's a Stark. He's a full Stark now.
Them factored into the end game. Winterfell, which a lot of people say, hey, Winterfell, this might be the place where the first war for the Dawn and the Long Night ended.
I never put that together.
It's always the little things.
That's very good.
So I really do think the war happens there. I do think that's where the Night King
that would also,
meets.
If you want to tie it into Tolkien in a nice, like the Tree of Gondor, Tree of Winterfell, that's where the war, like that becomes the focal moment of the end of the war. Like that would be a very
neat
circle.
It's where we started. Yeah. It's the Starks, you know, were the leading figures and then fell apart, but they've come back together and they've come back together at Winterfell.
Sure.
Like it just seems like the right kind of setting.
And if you think of so much of the show since the very beginning has been about there always has to be a Stark at Winterfell. Who's got control? Like Theon takes Winterfell. The Boltons take Winterfell. They got to keep getting it back.
It
would be a very fitting way to end the story to also have it come down to like whoever controls Winterfell at the end.
Winterfell at the end could be it. Something down there in the crypt. So therefore,
What do we think? The very first episode, you're down there in
you're
the
down
crypt.
Down there? Oh, yeah, and all that. Let's talk about Sansa. I want to talk about Sansa. And just some thoughts and predictions on where this character might go. You're right, Rachel. At the beginning of the show, she was intentionally supposed to be kind of the young, almost annoyingly naive wannabe princess. And she has absolutely grown into herself and grown into a person of power. And I think that was a lot of season 7. So now more than ever, I could see her end up as some kind of ruler, maybe the ruler of Winterfell.
Yeah, she is one of the few that I feel fairly confident survives at the end of all of this because of that arc, because of the fact that if you'd asked any of us at the beginning if she would, we'd probably be like, no. She's come a long way, and I feel like at the end of last season, I made a comment on the show that Ken and I were on that Sansa and Arya represent the two sides of Ned in a very deliberate way. When they took out Peter, I saw Sansa as the one who was passing the sentence and Arya as the one who swung the sword. So it sort of echoed some of Ned's, you know, earlier thoughts and philosophies on being a Stark and being a leader. And I feel like the girls have sort of become the two sides of that coin and they're working together. And I love that because I love the callback aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Sansa's the realist and the pragmatist of all of our Starks that are left. She's the one who understands the minutia. She's the one who actually understands people because of everything that she's been through. So I feel like while Jon and Dany are the focal point and the leaders and whatnot, I actually see the characters turning to somebody like Sansa as the person to see them through something like this.
I like that a lot.
Well, if you think about our remaining Starks, Sansa's the only one with political experience or experience at court, quote unquote, at this point. John's been in the wilderness. Arya's been living in the streets or in temple or whatever. Yeah. Like even Daenerys, like she's not necessarily great at diplomacy. She's great at what she's great at.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, I'm going to control all these lords and get them to follow me. Sansa's been there from the very, very beginning.
Right.
She's been the one watching all of this unfold. She's sort of watched Cersei. She is the one. So, yes, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
She's the one that the rest of them are going to have to turn to how to navigate ruling. Not just, you know, fighting a war, but, like, how do you actually, like, rule in this
Who's going to manage everybody? Like,
payroll.
You have Dothraki coming into the mix. Yeah. You have the southern armies. You have the northern people. You have people who are the wildlings, whatever's left of them, fighting with the northerners. They've never gotten along. You have these southerners coming in. You have these foreigners coming in. There's so many pieces to balance, and that's again one of the things that Game of Thrones never loses sight of. It's not just everybody comes together so easily because we've got to fight this threat. It's no, there's going to be issues within their own
and
side,
compromising. Yeah. And she's the one.
How are they
going to
get fed? How are they going to get all of that?
I love the idea because she's learned from. I love that moment. There was that moment last season where they kind of in a meta reference, almost like Sansa kind of liked Cersei in a way and liked the fan base. Well, we're like, she's horrible. I love love her.
Even the people that she's been under who Baelish, she's hated, right, she's learned things from. Yep. The Boltons and Peter Baelish. And exactly. That's like true. She's been a witness to the best manipulators and maneuvers in the Seven Kingdoms.
She might trade a few of the lessons for in exchange for what happened, right, but I agree, but she learned from everybody. Yeah,
the other thing...
You lost it.
I just had
The three-eyed raven kicked it out of your brain
second,
there.
Give me a second and I'll get back to it.
Yeah, and Sansa could be, if, again, I think a lot of us are on the same page that, you know, Iron Throne might not be there at the end. The wheel will be broken, et cetera. But if there's any semblance of rule, I think Sansa would be very beloved now inside the show. Oh, yeah, your point? Say. It came back.
So much of this show, I mean, so much of the theme, I think, overall of Game of Thrones, what defines so many of these characters is that loss of faith moment. That moment when you realize the thing that you have desperately clung to and believed isn't going to happen, and how you move beyond that, how you move past that moment. Sansa got hers out of the way really, really early. Her sheath was like, I'm going to be queen. I'm going to marry this.
I'm a princess in a castle. And I'm going to marry the prince.
Beautiful blonde prince, and he's going to be my king. And she realized by season two, like, oh, things don't work out the way you think, and you kind of have to just be resourceful and play things as they go. And she's learning this from Littlefinger, who's the master of it. Like, you know, figure out the situation and figure out the best angle.
Chaos, ladders, all that.
The characters where things don't work out so well for them are the characters that don't learn that lesson until it's too late. Your Ned Starks, who had faith in justice and law and, like, the right being done. Stannis, who had faith in the Lord of Light, was going to see him through until the moment that he didn't. And even Peter Baelish, believed in himself, and I can navigate anything, and I can get myself
out of anything.
Until he couldn't.
Rob Stark's an example. I'm avenging my father, and true love wins.
Right. And
not today.
And so, and I mean, I think one of the things that's kept Jon alive so long is he never really had a lot of, even in season one when he was off to the Night's Watch, he was like, no, it's good. You got to be in the Night's Watch. It's good. But even you could tell by episode three, he didn't really buy it.
And Tyrion is the only one going, oh, your precious Night's Watch.
I think that gives Sansa a very strong advantage going into the end, that she's had all of her illusions. She's been as disillusioned as a person could possibly be.
Right.
She's the ultimate pragmatist. She's the ultimate cynic now. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful, that's like Cersei, that's the powerful position to be in.
She's like a good Cersei.
She's like kind of like a good Cersei, because that was also Cersei. All of her children died. The prophecy came true. It's like, well,
horrible,
you can't believe in anything. Nothing. You just got to play it as it lies.
Sansa, she's going to be an interesting character in this final season.
Right.
Yeah.
I have another question with her. Talking about characters meeting up. This would be meeting up again, but I am so curious to see her and Tyrion in the same place again.
Yes,
after their, you know, actually wedding. Technically having been married.
And
I loved last year when he and John talked about her a little bit on Dragonstone, and I feel like that's a reunion I'm very excited to see.
Well, yeah, I mean, because she's going to be looking back and going, of all the people in my life who've done some horrible things, you weren't one of them.
Yep, right. That's very true.
You weren't one of them. That's interesting. Arya, our little warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Arya, who it'd be just this great character going back to season one. Just I was watching that stuff with her and Ned, oh, you'll be a, you know, you'll be a lady and you'll a princess and you'll have little, that's not me. And now it factors back to Nymeria. Great callback scene last season. So she's definitely going to factor. I still see her on a ship at the end going west of west and getting out of here. But I like what you're saying, Rachel. We got Sansa with the brain, so to speak. Not that Arya isn't smart, of course, and Arya with the steel in a way.
I like the way that they balance each other out. I mean, they're fleshed out characters in and of themselves, but I feel like their points of view are both valid. And when they work together is when, you know, I think they can accomplish the most. Right. But Arya, to me, is the hardest one to predict because everything that she's done. There's no way that at the end of it, she just becomes a lady in a castle. Like,
So
you're like, well, what's the alternative to that if she does survive? You know, I can't imagine the complete toppling of all societal norms in such a way that, you know, she would have a place. I'm not sure what that place would be. So I'm in love with your idea, like that it all goes down, you know, people are picking up the pieces and moving on with this new world that they have. And she's going to be like, I'm off to explore the edges of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, because again, I'm sorry, it's fresh in my brain. I keep referencing Fire and Blood, and I will not remember the name because there's a lot of names in that book, and they all sound the same. But there is the one Targaryen woman that decides she wants to explore, and she takes the ship and gets a crew, and she goes, and she kind of disappears. But the ship is seen in a Shai, which would be the other side of the world.
Hinting that, it wasn't a Targaryen, it was the lover Rhaenys.
So like hinting that the world is round and you can navigate.
Because that's never been established in this world.
You're at the far east or the west.
There's flat earthers in Westeros, trust me.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, and I know I come back to this a lot, so people who listen to this show might already be sick of me talking about it. I'm fascinated by the idea that we've been introduced to a variety of religions in Game of Thrones. And some of them we have strong evidence that there is a reason to have faith in that religion. There is a real power behind it. Others, maybe not so much. I don't think we've seen the Seven do a whole lot for people. But we've seen the Lord of Light create murderous smoke monsters. And the many-faced god. Yes. Arya has legitimately very, significant power now.
Yep.
And I feel like it would be weird for the show to just leave a person in the world with that level of power without it being applied to something. So I almost feel like she becomes a Jack and Hagar type figure. Not that, I know there's theories about who is he really. She becomes another figure like that, traveling the world, bestowing this power on people who are worthy and serving the many-faced god. That way, if you have a god who's real, you're going to be inclined, I think, to go back and serve them in some way.
Maybe she's like a new version of a faceless man.
That would be kind of my feel. Because now that scene at the twins where she is Walder Frey, and she's clearly been impersonating Walder Frey in a believable way for a significant amount of time. That's a powerful person.
I love that point too, because that's an in-show thing where as a viewer, I think some people could be taken out of it. She's wearing his face and all of a sudden she's speaking like, I look at it as a power.
It's absolutely a supernatural power. Yeah. It's not like she's just a really good impersonator.
Absolutely. She's not Rich Little. Right. Going around.
She's embodied. I mean, so that to me, that's also a potential answer for her. She would never be limited by being like a lady at this point because she could just choose to be a lord. we've now invested her with so much power that I feel like there's got to be some answer for her. So she's not just like a god among humans.
Which is why it is, Rachel, to your original point here, it is very hard to predict, to try to predict.
She's the hardest for me.
I would say maybe her and Melisandre, arguably the most, and Bran, the most powerful characters in the show.
And I do believe we're going to see her and Melisandre face off. Not necessarily face off. They'll be in the same room together.
Yeah. You've got to give us that nod.
Yeah, that would be the worst.
Don't leave us hanging on that one.
Hardest simple ever. At the time we have left here, we want to get through a lot tonight. I want to get some fan questions. We got to go to our man Jon Snow. He's Aegon Targaryen. What would that be? The 4th, 5th, 6th, 12th? I don't know. There's a lot of them.
Not going to be my stance.
Aegon the 4th, Aegon the 5th, 6th.
I'm trying to go through them.
Okay, but here's the thing. Aegon isn't in the show, so that's the thing that's throwing me off. So I guess he's the 7th, even though he wouldn't be in the books.
Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Jon Snow. All right, we got him and Dany. I think we can probably do an entire episode on Jon, Dany, getting busy in a ship and a kid coming, all these kind of theories and stuff. But to me, he is still fascinating because I still look to him. I look at Sansa, Arya, all of them, but I still look to him as the one to end the battle in a way. I'm still looking at Jon versus the Night King. Am I wrong there, Lon? You're scrunching your face. Rachel, what do we got?
There's no way. I mean, just I'll let Lon go. But Lon already said, the moment where the Night King's on the pier and he holds his hands up and Jon's in the boat, if that's not a we're going to meet and stand off at some point, I don't know what is. So
I think so, but at the same time, I don't know. The moment you become confident in this show is that's when he pulls the rug. And I feel like Jon Snow's almost at a Ned Stark level at this point.
That's true.
He's such a central place in the show.
Yeah.
And he's the moral beating heart protagonist. He's the one we most want to see.
Yeah.
That means he's not going to be the one. To me, I always feel like there's no way. George R. R. Martin knows how much we want that moment. And I don't think there's any way that we're going
to get it. I don't disagree with you at all there. But in terms of the war, maybe I still stand behind that. But I also don't think he factors into what comes on. Because
I think it might be like John's plan. And then someone else has to come in and execute it or something.
Even if he is unveiled as Aegon Targaryen, right? That's some good Star Wars poetry of going back to the beginning. Aegon's conquest 300 years. But we got also 10,000 years of history. But it doesn't seem to me that it doesn't seem like the story works. And again, you're right, Lon. The moment you think you know, that's when it changes. It starts with Aegon the Conqueror, this modern history of Game of Thrones. And ending with Aegon doesn't seem like something George R. R. Martin would want to do. It's not just all this big Targaryen history. It just seems like that's not the ending that we're going to get. Jon on the throne.
It's no. 100% no. Yeah. I don't see him surviving. I think that there's no... It would just be too weird, and I feel like there's certain story tropes, if you will, that Martin in the show does follow through with, and I feel like the idea of him having been brought back from the dead, to me, means it's for a very singular purpose.
I agree with that.
And I think as a military leader, as the beating heart of the movement to oppose the Night King, is absolutely going to happen, but then... something will happen in that, like Lon said, whether he falls or dies in an unexpected way or sacrifice. I actually see him sacrificing himself to do a thing that maybe wasn't what we all thought, but then somebody else picks up the mantle and finishes it in some way, shape, or form. Like, I do, that makes sense to me because it falls within the purview of Game of Thrones and the way that it does things, but it also honors and gives Jon the moment that we all frankly want him to have.
Yeah, I think Jon gets a big hero moment, and he's been brought back to life. He's got some vital role to play. Right. I just don't think it's leading the armies of the North in a successful campaign against the Night King.
Sure. Right.
I just can't. I could see somebody maybe doing that, but I don't think it's Jon. I also do not think, I know we're not talking about him.
Yeah.
I don't think Tyrion's going to survive.
You don't think Tyrion's? Okay, that's interesting. Interesting. Why do you think that? I'd love to have that.
Because I think that his death would be such a... I'm not sure the show could resist that moment of how meaningful that would be to people, especially if he goes in a very noble way, way. I think that it's such a fan beloved character, and that would be such a big moment. I think that he's going to go out blaze of glory.
Okay.
Style somehow.
I like that there. It's funny. I like that.
If that happens, then I would put money on Jaime living.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm with you.
Okay. Like, I feel like a Lannister survives this.
I'm with you on this. I think Jaime's one of the last standing.
This is a good transition to the fan questions. Okay. I've got fan questions for my Discord server, which you can access by being a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/KenKnapsack. That's my overall brand, but you get access to this little, I put out the chance to ask questions. And Tim Van Newland, who actually is my Discord admin, helped there. He says, question for Casterly Talk people. Which Lannister or Lannisters will still be alive at the end of the season? You both are going to Jaime. Does that mean Cersei kaput? Oh. Tyrion kaput? What do you think, Rachel?
Cersei's done. I think that her arc means that she will. And I do Valonqar, whatever. Like, it's
sure.
Whether or not that's it, like, it has to involve Jaime in some way, just because their relationship has to have closure in some way. If Tyrion dies, Jaime lives.
Okay.
Probably vice versa as well. The only reason why I could see, not only reason, but a reason I could see Tyrion surviving is that throwaway line from last season where he's like, basically says, if I survive all of this, I'm just going to go down the arbor and I'm going to have myself a little vineyard and like, I'm going to live out my days.
Right.
On any other show, that means he dies. On this show, it almost makes me want to go the complete opposite
The last scene will be him on a vineyard.
If he actually said that and that actually happened, that goes against the grain of the show.
That's true.
And because, like Lon said, for the very reason that his death would strike such a chord with the fans, him living through would be that one through line character, that one major character from the get-go that sees it all out, who is probably scarred for life for having seen it all out, but, you know, makes it to the other side. Because if most people consider Dany, Jon, and Tyrion the big three, the main three, I'm so convinced that both Dany and Jon die, then that's what makes me think Tyrion might be safe.
Okay. But Lon, you're saying kaput on Tyrion, kaput on Tyrion, Cersei.
I think Jaime is that really complicated character who's been on this very interesting, unexpected sort of redemptive arc for the last few years. And that's why I think he's the guy that we end up with at the end.
And I wouldn't hate that. Yeah.
In terms of, not that he's like the only survivor. But in terms of the Lannisters, I think Cersei's gone. And I think, Tyrion's going to go down in a big showy way that's going to make us all feel feelings. And then I think Jamie's the one who he's going to have seen this all through. He's going to think about how different a place he's going to be in at the end than where he started and what he sort of learned from this experience. And I mean, also, I think the fascinating thing about where Jamie would be at the end is he's never been without Cersei. I mean, like Jaime Lannister having control of the Lannisters, whatever the landscape looks like after this, and having to, for the very first time, make decisions about what he wants to do and what he thinks is right rather than what's best for him and his sister together, I think is a really interesting...
That's really interesting to me. Yeah. I've never really... I've thought a lot about Tyrion dying, and I just don't want it.
No, I don't want it.
But it makes sense, Lon, what you're saying. You're kind of convincing me a little bit. Like, hey, there could be a great death scene and a lot of death scenes. Jaime would be the one for me that learns the most, exactly. So that makes a lot of sense.
Cersei Jamie and Bronn ended up together.
They start a restaurant together.
Like Bronn's got a small castle next to Castle
Rock. As far as Cersei, even removing the Valonqar prophecy, which is at this point mostly booked, though they do go to Maggie the Frog, and that doesn't really get covered. But it just seems like it's still going to end that way. I have resigned myself to the fact that Cersei will die, and I say that because I really do like this character. I really do love, much like I love Tywin, there's something about them, both those characters, that I'm like, I understand some of your point of view, and that's what Game of Thrones does. Mm-hmm. And the Cersei stuff, going back to season one, watching her in the Battle of Blackwater when she's drunk and harassing it's just some of the best work from Lena Headey. Yep. I do get she'll die. I wouldn't mind there being some sort of personal redemption, emotional redemption, or some kind of realization of all the things she did wrong, and that's why she's dying, but there's still peace in her death. I don't know. Am I crazy?
No, because that you just hit on the thing about Game of Thrones. There are pure evil characters, Ramsay, Joffrey, Viserys,
the Night King.
Yeah, but they're all like actually psychologically damaged or wrong in some way, shape, or form. The other quote-unquote villains are still fleshed out human beings, and Tywin is absolutely one of them. Even Roos Bolton is one of them. Like, they have motivations and they have points of view that you at least can understand if you don't necessarily sympathize. And Cersei, you can actually sympathize with. So there is absolutely room there for, I think, the arc needs to end with her death, but it will be an emotionally affecting death. Mm-hmm. And I think even more so if they give her, like you said, some sort of moment or realization or a small action that she does right before it happens or when it's happening or whatever that acknowledges, I didn't always get this right. Yeah. And,
get behind that.
Yeah.
Man, I go back to that season two scene where she's talking with Tyrion about her children, about her children. And there's a real love there. And there's a real thought of, this is maybe the cost of our sins and all that. Some heartbreaking stuff there. So I think she's going to die. I hope there's some peace, maybe in the afterlife, for Cersei Lannister. Well, we've talked about a lot. We've covered a lot of ground. And I don't want to, we could go for 2 hours, but I don't want to, and I'm sure some of you listening want that, but we will wrap up tonight's conversation. This is always fun. I can't wait to cover this final season with these fine folks here and some other names and voices lending their talents to the show. So this is a lot of fun. Hope you guys out there listening like it. There is a Facebook page, Casterly Talk. I set that up a long time ago just to reserve the space with Lon's excellent name. So you can go like us there. This show is on Anchor, which means you can support the show directly on Anchor. You can also favorite. I do suggest getting that app if you want to listen to it on the go, but the show is available in 12 other spots, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. A lot of wonderful places like that. So check it out. You can follow me at Ken Knapps, I'll use hashtag Casterly Talk, but also follow these fine folks. Rachel, where do you want them to find you?
I'm at Rachel J. Cushing.
Mr. Lon Harris over there. We're doing the Lord's work at Screen Junkies.
Yeah, find me on Twitter at LONS.
The best Twitter handle ever.
Four letters.
You got there early and you got there often. That is it for now on Casterly Talk. We'll see you all next week.